That is the worst. The directors admit so indiscriminately. But one is sure to hear the newest music there. I always have a large order to give to Johnson's the day after a concert. Do you like new music simply for its newness, then? Oh, one knows it is the fashion in London, or else the singers would not bring it down here. You have been in London, of course?
Yes, said Margaret. I have lived there for several years.
Oh, London and the Alhambra are the two places I long to see.
London and the Alhambra?
Yes, ever since I read the tales of the Alhambra. Don't you know them?
I don't think I do, but surely it is a very easy journey to London.
Yes, but somehow, said Fanny, lowering her voice, Mama has never been to London herself and can't understand my longing. She is very proud of Milton. Dirty, smoky place, as I feel it to be. I believe she admires it the more for those very qualities.
If it has been Mrs. Thornton's home for some years, I can well understand her loving it, said Margaret in her clear, bell-like voice.
What are you saying about me, Miss Hale? May I inquire?
Margaret had not the words ready for an answer to this question, which took her a little by surprise, so Miss Thornton replied,
Oh, Mama, we are only trying to account for your being so fond of Milton.
Thank you, said Mrs. Thornton. I do not feel that my very natural liking for the place where I was born and brought up, and which has been my residence for some years, requires any accounting for.
Margaret was vexed. As Fanny had put it, it did seem as if they had been impertinently discussing Mrs. Thornton's feelings. But she also rose up against that lady's manner of showing that she was offended. Mrs. Thornton went on after a moment's pause.
Do you know anything of Milton, Miss Hale? Have you seen any of our factories, our magnificent warehouses?
No, said Margaret. I have not seen anything of that description as yet. Then she felt that by concealing her utter indifference to all such places, she was hardly speaking with truth, so she went on. I dare say Papa would have taken me before now if I had cared, but I really do not find much pleasure in going over manufactories.
They are very curious places, said Mrs. Hale, but there is so much noise and dirt always. I remember once going in a lilac silk to see candles made, and my gown was utterly ruined.
Very probably, said Mrs. Thornton in a short, displeased manner. I merely thought that as strangers newly come to reside in a town which has risen to eminence in the country, from the character and progress of its peculiar business, you might have cared to visit some of the places where it is carried on. Places unique in the kingdom, I am informed. If Miss Hale changes her mind and condescends to be curious as to the manufactures of Milton, I can only say I shall be glad to procure her admission to print works or reed-making, or the more simple operations of spinning carried on in my son's mill. Every improvement of machinery is, I believe, to be seen there in its highest perfection.
I am so glad you don't like mills and manufactories and all those kind of things, said Fanny in a half-whisper as she rose to accompany her mother, who was taking leave of Mrs. Hale with rustling dignity.
I think I should like to know all about them if I were you, replied Margaret quietly.
Fanny, said her mother as they drove away, we will be civil to these Hales, but don't form one of your hasty friendships with the daughter. She will do you no good, I see. The mother looks very ill and seems a nice, quiet kind of person.
I don't want to form any friendship with Miss Hale, Mama, said Fanny, pouting. I thought I was doing my duty by talking to her and trying to amuse her.
Well, at any rate, John must be satisfied now.
Chapter 13. A Soft Breeze in a Sultry Place. The doubt and trouble, fear and pain, and anguish all are shadows vain, that death itself shall not remain. That weary deserts we may tread, a dreary labyrinth may thread, through dark ways underground be led. Yet if we will one guide obey, the dreariest path, the darkest way, shall issue out in heavenly day. And we on divers shores now cast, shall meet our perilous voyage past, all in our Father's house at last. R.C. Trench.
Margaret flew up the stairs as soon as their visitors were gone and put on her bonnet and shawl to run and inquire how Bessie Higgins was and sit with her as long as she could before dinner. As she went along the crowded narrow streets, she felt how much of interest they had gained by the simple fact of her having learnt to care for a dweller in them. Mary Higgins, the slatternly younger sister, had endeavoured as well as she could to tidy up the house for the expected visit. There had been rough stoning done in the middle of the floor, while the flags under the chairs and table and round the walls retained their dark, unwashed appearance. Although the day was hot, there burnt a large fire in the grate, making the whole place feel like an oven. Margaret did not understand that the lavishness of coals was a sign of hospitable welcome to her on Mary's part, and thought that perhaps the oppressive heat was necessary for Bessie. Bessie herself lay on a squab or short sofa placed under the window. She was very much more feeble than on the previous day, and tired with raising herself at every step to look out and see if it was Margaret coming. And now that Margaret was there and had taken a chair by her, Bessie lay back silent and content to look at Margaret's face and touch her articles of dress, with a childish admiration of their fineness of texture. "I never knew why folk in the Bible cared for soft raiment afore, but it must be nice to go dressed as you do. It's different for common. Most fine folk tie my eyes out with their colours, but somehow yours rest me. Where did you get this frock?" "In London," said Margaret, much amused. "London? Have you been in London?" "Yes, I lived there for some years, but my home was in a forest, in the country." "Tell me about it," said Bessie. "I like to hear speak of the country and trees and such like things." She leant back and shut her eye and crossed her hands over her breast, lying at perfect rest, as if to receive all the ideas Margaret could suggest. Margaret had never spoken of Helston since she left it, except just naming the place incidentally. She saw it in dreams more vivid than life, and as she fell away to slumber at nights, her memory wandered in all its pleasant places. But her heart was opened to this girl. "Oh, Bessie, I loved the home we have left so dearly. I wish you could see it. I cannot tell you half its beauty. There are great trees standing all about it, with their branches stretching long and level, and making a deep shade of rest even at noonday. And yet, though every leaf may seem still, there is a continual rushing sound of movement all around, not close at hand. Then sometimes the turf is as soft and fine as velvet, and sometimes quite lush with the perpetual moisture of a little hidden tinkling brook near at hand. And then in other parts there are billowy ferns, whole stretches of fern, some in the green shadow, some with long streaks of golden sunlight lying on them, just like the sea." "I have never seen the sea," murmured Bessie, "but go on." "Then here and there there are wide commons, high up as if above the very tops of the trees. I'm glad of that. I felt smothered like down below. When I have gone for an out, I've always wanted to get high up and see far away, and take a deep breath of fullness in that air. I get smothered enough in Milton, and I think the sound you speak of among the trees, going on forever and ever, would send me dazed. It's that made my head ache so in the mill. Now on these commons I reckon there is but little noise." "No," said Margaret, "nothing but here and there a lark high in the air. Sometimes I used to hear a farmer speaking sharp and loud to his servants, but it was so far away that it only reminded me pleasantly that other people were hard at work in some distant place, while I just sat on the heather and did nothing. I used to think once that if I could have a day of doing nothing to rest me, a day in some quiet place like that you speak on, it would maybe set me up. But now I've had many days of idleness, and I'm just as weary of them as I was of my work. Sometimes I'm so tired out, I think I cannot enjoy heaven without a piece of rest first. I'm rather afeard of going straight there without getting a good sleep in the grave to set me up." "Don't be afraid, Bessie," said Margaret, laying her hand on the girl's. God can give you more perfect rest than even idleness on earth, or the dead sleep of the grave can do. Bessie moved uneasily. Then she said, I wish Father would not speak as he does. He means well, as I told you yesterday, and tell you again and again. But you see, though I don't believe him a bit by day, yet by night, when I'm in a fever, half asleep and half awake, he comes back upon me, oh, so bad. And I think, if this should be the end of all, and if all I've been born for is just to work my heart and my life away, and to sicken in this dree place, with their mill noises in my ears forever, until I could scream out for them to stop, and let me have a little piece of quiet, and with a fluff filling my lungs, until I thirst to death for one long deep breath of the clear air you speak on, and my mother gone, and I never able to tell her again how I loved her, and her all my troubles. I think if this life is the end, and that there's no God to wipe away all tears from all eyes, yo, wench, yo, said she, sitting up and clutching violently, almost fiercely at Margaret's hand, I could go mad and kill you, I could. She fell back, completely worn out with her passion. Margaret knelt down by her. Bessie, we have a Father in heaven.
I know it, I know it, moaned she,
turning her head uneasily from side to side.
I'm very wicked. I've spoken very wickedly. Oh, don't be frightened by me and never come again. I would not harm a hair of your head. And,
opening her eyes and looking earnestly at Margaret,
I believe perhaps more than you do or what's to come. I read the book of Revelations until I know it off by heart, and I never doubt when I'm waking and in my senses of all the glory I'm to come to.
Don't let us talk of what fancies come into your head when you are feverish. I would rather hear something about what you used to do when you were well.
I think I was well when Mother died, but I've never been rightly strong since somewhere about that time.
I began to work in a carding room soon after, and the fluff got into my lungs and poisoned me.
Fluff? Said Margaret inquiringly.
Fluff, repeated Bessie. Little bits as fly off through the cotton when they're carding it and fill the air till it looks all fine white dust.
They say it winds round the lungs and tightens them up.
Anyhow, there's many a one as works in a carding room that falls into a waste, coughing and spitting blood because they're just poisoned by the fluff.
But can't it be helped? Asked Margaret.
I dunno. Some folk have a great wheel at one end of their carding rooms to make a draught and carry off the dust. But that wheel costs a deal of money, 500 or 600 pound maybe, and brings in no profit, so it's but a few of the masters as will put 'em up. And I've heard tell of men who didn't like working places where there was a wheel, because they said as how it made 'em hungry, it after they'd been long used to swallowing fluff, don't go without it, and that their wage ought to be raised if they were to work in such places. So between masters and men the wheels fall through. I know I wish there'd been a wheel in our place, though.
Did not your father know about it? Asked Margaret.
Yes, and he was sorry, but our factory were a good one on the whole, and a steady, likely set of people, and father was afeard of letting me go to a strange place. But though you would not think it now, many a one then used to call me a gradely lass enough, and I did not like to be reckoned nesh and soft, and Mary's schooling were to be kept up, mother said, and father, he were always liking to buy books and go to lectures of one kind or another, all which took money. So I just worked on till I shall ne'er get the whir out of my ears or the fluff out of my throat in this world. That's all.
How old are you? Asked Margaret.
19 come July.
And I too am 19, she thought more sorrowfully than Bessie did of the contrast between them. She could not speak for a moment or two for the emotion she was trying to keep down.
About Mary, said Bessie, I wanted to ask you to be a friend to her. She's 17, but she's the last on us, and I don't want her to go to the mill, and yet I don't know what she's fit for.
She could not do. Margaret glanced unconsciously at the uncleaned corners of the room. She could hardly undertake a servant's place, could she?
We have an old faithful servant, almost a friend, who wants help, but who is very particular, and it would not be right to plague her with giving her any assistance that would really be an annoyance and an irritation.
No, I see. I reckon you're right. Our Mary's a good wench, but who has she had to teach her what to do about a house? No mother, and me at the mill till I were good for nothing but scolding her for doing badly what I didn't know how to do a bit. But I wish she could have lived with you for all that. But even though she may not be exactly fitted to come and live with us as a servant, and I don't know about that, I will always try and be a friend to her for your sake, Bessie. And now I must go. I will come again as soon as I can. But if it should not be tomorrow or the next day, or even a week or a fortnight hence, don't think I've forgotten you. I may be busy. I'll know you won't forget me again. I'll not mistrust you no more. But remember, in a week or a fortnight I may be dead and buried. I'll come as soon as I can, Bessie, said Margaret, squeezing her hand tight. But you'll let me know if you are worse.
Aye, that will I, said Bessie, returning the pressure. From that day forwards, Mrs. Hale became more and more of a suffering invalid. It was now drawing near to the anniversary of Edith's marriage, and looking back upon the year's accumulated heap of troubles, Margaret wondered how they had been borne. If she could have anticipated them, how she would have shrunk away and hid herself from the coming time. And yet day by day had, of itself and by itself, been very endurable, small, keen, bright little spots of positive enjoyment having come sparkling into the very middle of sorrows. A year ago, or when she first went to Helston, and first became silently conscious of the querulousness in her mother's temper, she would have grown bitterly over the idea of a long illness to be borne in a strange, desolate, noisy, busy place, with diminished comforts on every side of the home life. But with the increase of serious and just ground of complaint, a new kind of patience had sprung up in her mother's mind. She was gentle and quiet in intense bodily suffering, almost in proportion as she had been restless and depressed when there had been no real cause for grief. Mr. Hale was in exactly that stage of apprehension which, in men of his stamp, takes the shape of willful blindness. He was more irritated than Margaret had ever known him at his daughter's expressed anxiety.
"Indeed, Margaret, you are growing fanciful. God knows I should be the first to take the alarm if your mother were really ill. We always saw when she had her headaches at Helston, even without her telling us. She looks quite pale and white when she is ill, and now she has a bright, healthy colour in her cheeks, just as she used to have when I first knew her."
"But, Papa," said Margaret with hesitation, "do you know, I think that is the flush of pain."
"Nonsense, Margaret. I tell you, you are too fanciful. You are the person not well, I think. Send for the doctor tomorrow for yourself, and then, if it will make your mind easier, he can see your mother."
"Thank you, dear Papa. It will make me happier indeed." And she went up to kiss him, but he pushed her away, gently enough, but still as if she had suggested unpleasant ideas, which he should be glad to get rid of as readily as he could of her presence. He walked uneasily up and down the room.
"Poor Maria," said he, half soliloquizing. "I wish one could do right without sacrificing others. I shall hate this town, and myself too, if she... Pray, Margaret, does your mother often talk to you of the old places of Helston, I mean?"
"No, Papa," said Margaret sadly.
"Then, you see, she can't be fretting after them, eh? It has always been a comfort to me to think that your mother was so simple and open that I knew every little grievance she had. She never would conceal anything seriously affecting her health from me. Would she, eh, Margaret? I am quite sure she would not. So, don't let me hear of these foolish, morbid ideas. Come, give me a kiss and run off to bed."
But she heard him pacing about, raccooning, as she and Edith used to call it, long after her slow and languid undressing was finished, long after she began to listen as she lay in bed. Chapter 14. The Meeting. I was used to sleep at nights as sweetly as a child. Now if the wind blew up, it made me start and think of my poor boy tossing about upon the roaring seas. And then I seemed to feel that it was hard to take him from me for such a little fault. Southey. It was a comfort to Margaret about this time to find that her mother drew more tenderly and intimately towards her than she had ever done since the days of her childhood. She took her to her heart as a confidential friend. The post Margaret had always longed to fill and had envied Dixon for being preferred to. Margaret took pains to respond to every call made upon her for sympathy, and there were many, even when they bore relation to trifles, which she would no more have noticed or regarded herself than the elephant would perceive the little pin at his feet, which yet he lifts carefully up at the bidding of his keeper. All unconsciously Margaret drew near to a reward. One evening, Mr. Hale being absent, her mother began to talk to her about her brother Frederick, the very subject on which Margaret had longed to ask questions, and almost the only one on which her timidity overcame her natural openness. The more she wanted to hear about him, the less likely she was to speak. "Oh, Margaret, it was so windy last night. It came howling down the chimney in our room. I could not sleep. I never can when there is such a terrible wind. I got into a wakeful habit when poor Frederick was at sea, and now even if I don't waken all at once, I dream of him in some stormy sea, with great clear glass-green walls of waves on either side of his ship, but far higher than her very masts, curling over her with that cruel, terrible white foam, like some gigantic crested serpent. It is an old dream, but it always comes back on windy nights, till I am thankful to waken, sitting straight and stiff up in bed with my terror. Poor Frederick, he is on land now, so wind can do him no harm, though I did think it might shake down some of those tall chimneys. Where is Frederick now, Mama? Our letters are directed to the care of Messrs. Barber at Cadiz, I know, but where is he himself? I can't remember the name of the place, but he is not called Hale. You must remember that, Margaret. Notice the FD in every corner of the letters. He has taken the name of Dickinson. I wanted him to have been called Beresford, to which he had a kind of right, but your father thought he had better not. He might be recognized, you know, if he were called by my name. Mama, said Margaret, I was at Aunt Shaw's when it all happened, and I suppose I was not old enough to be told plainly about it, but I should like to know now, if I may, if it does not give you too much pain to speak about it. Pain? No, replied Mrs. Hale, her cheek flushing. Yet it is pain to think that perhaps I may never see my darling boy again. Or else he did write, Margaret. They may say what they like, but I have his own letters to show, and I'll believe him, though he is my son, sooner than any court-martial on earth. Go to my little Japan cabinet, dear, and in the second left-hand drawer you will find a packet of letters. Margaret went. There were the yellow sea-stained letters, with the peculiar fragrance which ocean letters have. Margaret carried them back to her mother, who untied the silken string with trembling fingers, and examining their dates, she gave them to Margaret to read, making her hurried, anxious remarks on their contents, almost before her daughter could have understood what they were. You see, Margaret, how from the very first he disliked Captain Reed. He was second lieutenant in the ship, the Orion, in which Frederick sailed the very first time. Poor little fellow, how well he looked in his midshipman's dress, with his dirk in his hand, cutting open all the newspapers with it, as if it were a paper knife. But this Mr. Reed, as he was then, seemed to take a dislike to Frederick from the very beginning. And then, stay, these are the letters he wrote on board the Russell. When he was appointed to her, and found his old enemy Captain Reed in command, he did mean to bear all his tyranny patiently. Look, this is the letter. Just read it, Margaret. Where is it, he says? Stop. My father may rely upon me, but I will bear with all proper patience everything that one officer and gentleman can take from another. but from my former knowledge of my present captain, I confess I look forward with apprehension to a long course of tyranny on board the Russell. You see, he promises to bear patiently, and I am sure he did, for he was the sweetest-tempered boy, when he was not vexed, that could possibly be. Is that the letter in which he speaks of Captain Reed's impatience with the men, for not going through the ship's manoeuvres as quickly as the Avenger? You see, he says that they had many new hands on board the Russell, while the Avenger had been nearly 3 years on the station, with nothing to do but keep the slavers off and work her men till they ran up and down the rigging like rats or monkeys. Margaret slowly read the letter, half illegible through the fading of the ink. It might be, it probably was, a statement of Captain Reed's imperiousness in trifles, very much exaggerated by the narrator, who had written it while fresh and warm from the scene of altercation. Some sailors being aloft in the main topsail rigging, the captain had ordered them to race down, threatening the hindmost with the cat-o'-nine-tails. He who was the farthest on the spar, feeling the impossibility of passing his companions, and yet passionately dreading the disgrace of the flogging, threw himself desperately down to catch a rope considerably lower, failed and fell senseless on deck. He only survived for a few hours afterwards, and the indignation of the ship's crew was at boiling point when young Hale wrote, "But we did not receive this letter till long, long after we heard of the mutiny. Poor Fred! I dare say it was a comfort to him to write it, even though he could not have known how to send it, poor fellow. And then we saw a report in the papers, that's to say long before Fred's letter reached us, of an atrocious mutiny having broken out on board the Russell, and that the mutineers had remained in possession of the ship, which had gone off, it was supposed, to be a pirate, and that Captain Reed was sent adrift in a boat with some men, officers or something, whose names were all given, for they were picked up by a West Indian steamer. Oh, Margaret, how your father and I turned sick over that list, when there was no name of Frederick Hale. We thought it must be some mistake, for poor Fred was such a fine fellow, only perhaps rather too passionate, and we hoped that the name of Carr, which was in the list, was a misprint for that of Hale. Newspapers are so careless. And towards post-time the next day, Papa set off to walk to Southampton to get the papers, and I could not stop at home, so I went to meet him. He was very late, much later than I thought he would have been, and I sat down under the hedge to wait for him. He came at last, his arms hanging loose down, his head sunk, and walking heavily along, as if every step was a labour and a trouble. Margaret, I see him now. "Don't go on, Mama. I can understand it all," said Margaret, leaning up caressingly against her mother's side and kissing her hand. "No, you can't, Margaret. No one can who did not see him then. I could hardly lift myself up to go and meet him. Everything seemed so to reel around me all at once. And when I got to him, he did not speak or seemed surprised to see me there, more than 3 miles from home, beside the Oldham beech tree. But he put my arm in his and kept stroking my hand, as if he wanted to soothe me to be very quiet under some great heavy blow. And when I trembled so all over that I could not speak, he took me in his arms and stooped down his head on mine and began to shake and to cry in a strange muffled groaning voice, till I, for very fright, stood quite still, and only begged him to tell me what he had heard. And then, with his hand jerking, as if someone else moved it against his will, he gave me a wicked newspaper to read, calling our Frederick a traitor of the blackest dye, a base ungrateful disgrace to his profession. Oh, I cannot tell what bad words they did not use. I took the paper in my hands as soon as I had read it. I tore it up to little bits. I tore it. Oh, I believe, Margaret, I tore it with my teeth. I did not cry. I could not. My cheeks were as hot as fire, and my very eyes burnt in my head. I saw your father looking grave at me. I said it was a lie, and so it was. Months after this letter came, and you see what provocation Frederick had. It was not for himself or his own injuries he rebelled. But he would speak his mind to Captain Reed, and so it went on from bad to worse. And you see, most of the sailors stuck by Frederick. I think, Margaret, she continued after a pause, in a weak, trembling, exhausted voice, I am glad of it. I am prouder of Frederick standing up against injustice than if he had been simply a good officer.
I am sure I am, said Margaret in a firm, decided tone. Loyalty and obedience to wisdom and justice are fine, but it is still finer to defy arbitrary power, unjustly and cruelly used, not on behalf of ourselves, but on behalf of others more helpless.
For all that, I wish I could see Frederick once more. Just once. He was my first baby, Margaret.
Mrs. Hale spoke wistfully, and almost as if apologizing for the yearning, craving wish, as though it were a depreciation of her remaining child. But such an idea never crossed Margaret's mind. She was thinking how her mother's desire could be fulfilled. It is 6 or 7 years ago. Would they still prosecute him, Mother? If he came and stood his trial, what would be the punishment? Surely he might bring evidence of his great provocation.
It would do no good, replied Mrs. Hale. Some of the sailors who accompanied Frederick were taken, and there was a court-martial held on them on board the Amicia. I believed all they said in their defense, poor fellows, because it just agreed with Frederick's story, but it was of no use.
And for the first time during the conversation, Mrs. Hale began to cry. Yet something possessed Margaret to force the information she foresaw, yet dreaded, from her mother. What happened to them, Mama? Asked she.
They were hung at the yardarm, said Mrs. Hale solemnly, and the worst was that the court, in condemning them to death, said they had suffered themselves to be led astray from their duty by their superior officers.
They were silent for a long time. And Frederick was in South America for several years, was he not?
Yes, and now he is in Spain, at Cadiz or somewhere near it. If he comes to England, he will be hung. I shall never see his face again, for if he comes to England, he will be hung.
There was no comfort to be given. Mrs. Hale turned her face to the wall, and lay perfectly still in her mother's despair. Nothing could be said to console her. She took her hand out of Margaret's with a little impatient movement, as if she would fain be left alone with the recollection of her son. When Mr. Hale came in, Margaret went out, oppressed with gloom, and seeing no promise of brightness on any side of the horizon. Chapter 15 Masters and Men. Thought fights with thought. Out springs a spark of truth from the collision of the sword and shield. W. S. Landor. Margaret, said her father the next day, we must return Mrs. Thornton's call. Your mother is not very well, and thinks she cannot walk so far, but you and I will go this afternoon. As they went, Mr. Hale began about his wife's health, with a kind of veiled anxiety which Margaret was glad to see awakened at last. Did you consult the doctor, Margaret? Did you send for him?
No, Papa. You spoke of his coming to see me. Now I was well. But if I only knew of some good doctor, I would go this afternoon and ask him to come, for I am sure Mama is seriously indisposed.
She put the truth thus plainly and strongly, because her father had so completely shut his mind against the idea when she had last named her fears. But now the case was changed. He answered in a despondent tone.
Do you think she has any hidden complaint? Do you think she is really very ill?
Has Dixon said anything?
Oh, Margaret, I am haunted by the fear that our coming to Milton has killed her. My poor Maria.
Oh, Papa, don't imagine such things, said Margaret, shocked. She is not well, that is all. Many a one is not well for a time, and with good advice gets better and stronger than ever.
But has Dixon said anything about her?
No. You know Dixon enjoys making a mystery out of trifles, and she has been a little mysterious about Mama's health, which has alarmed me rather, that is all. Without any reason, I dare say. You know, Papa, you said the other day I was getting fanciful.
I hope and trust you are. But don't think of what I said then.
I like you to be fanciful about your mother's health. Don't be afraid of telling me your fancies. I like to hear them, though I dare say I spoke as if I was annoyed. But we will ask Mrs. Thornton if she can tell us of a good doctor. We won't throw away our money on any but someone first-rate. Stay. We turn up the street."
The street did not look as if it could contain any house large enough for Mrs. Thornton's habitation. Her son's presence never gave any impression as to the kind of house he lived in. But unconsciously, Margaret had imagined that tall, massive, handsomely dressed Mrs. Thornton must live in a house of the same character as herself. Now Marlborough Street consisted of long rows of small houses, with a blank wall here and there. At least, that was all they could see from the point at which they entered it.
"He told me he lived in Marlborough Street, I'm sure," said Mr. Hale, with a much perplexed air.
"Perhaps it is one of the economies he still practices, to live in a very small house. But here are plenty of people about. Let me ask." She accordingly inquired of a passer-by, and was informed that Mr. Thornton lived close to the mill and had the factory lodge door pointed out to her at the end of the long, dead wall they had noticed. The lodge door was like a common garden door. On one side of it were great closed gates for the ingress and egress of lorries and wagons. The lodge-keeper admitted them into a great oblong yard, on one side of which were offices for the transaction of business. On the opposite, an immense many-windowed mill, whence proceeded the continual clank of machinery and the long groaning roar of the steam engine, enough to deafen those who lived within the enclosure. Opposite to the wall, along which the street ran, on one of the narrow sides of the oblong, was a handsome stone-coped house, blackened, to be sure, by the smoke, but with paint, windows, and steps kept scrupulously clean. It was evidently a house which had been built some 50 or 60 years. The stone facings, the long narrow windows and the number of them, the flights of steps up to the front door, ascending from either side and guarded by railing, all witnessed to its age. Margaret only wondered why people who could afford to live in so good a house and kept it in such perfect order did not prefer a much smaller dwelling in the country, or even some suburb. Not in the continual whirl and din of the factory. Her unaccustomed ears could hardly catch her father's voice as they stood on the steps awaiting the opening of the door. The yard, too, with the great doors in the dead wall as a boundary, was but a dismal lookout for the sitting rooms of the house, as Margaret found when they had mounted the old-fashioned stairs and been ushered into the drawing-room, the three windows of which went over the front door and the room on the right-hand side of the entrance. There was no one in the drawing-room. It seemed as though no one had been in it since the day when the furniture was bagged up with as much care as if the house was to be overwhelmed with lava and discovered 1,000 years hence. The walls were pink and gold. The pattern on the carpet represented bunches of flowers on a light ground, but it was carefully covered up in the centre by a linen drugget, glazed and colourless. The window curtains were lace. Each chair and sofa had its own particular veil of netting or knitting. Great alabaster groups occupied every flat surface, safe from dust under their glass shades. In the middle of the room, right under the bagged-up chandelier, was a large circular table, with smartly bound books arranged at regular intervals round the circumference of its polished surface, like gaily coloured spokes of a wheel. Everything reflected light, nothing absorbed it. The whole room had a painfully spotted, spangled, speckled look about it, which impressed Margaret so unpleasantly that she was hardly conscious of the peculiar cleanliness required to keep everything so white and pure in such an atmosphere, or if the trouble that must be willingly expended to secure that effect of icy, snowy discomfort. Wherever she looked, there was evidence of care and labour, but not care and labour to procure ease, to help on habits of tranquil home employment, solely to ornament, and then to preserve ornament from dirt or destruction. They had leisure to observe and to speak to each other in low voices before Mrs. Thornton appeared. They were talking of what all the world might hear, but it is a common effect of such a room as this to make people speak low, as if unwilling to awaken the unused echoes. At last Mrs. Thornton came in, rustling in handsome black silk, as was her wont,
her muslins and laces rivaling, not excelling, the pure whiteness of the muslins and netting of the room. Margaret explained how it was, but her mother could not accompany them to return Mrs. Thornton's call. But in her anxiety not to bring back her father's fears too vividly, she gave but a bungling account, and left the impression on Mrs. Thornton's mind that Mrs. Hales was some temporary or fanciful, fine ladyish indisposition, which might have been put aside had there been a strong enough motive, or but if it was too severe to allow her to come out that day, the call might have been deferred. Remembering, too, the horses to her carriage, hired for her own visit to the Hales, and how Fanny had been ordered to go by Mr. Thornton, in order to pay every respect to them, Mrs. Thornton drew up slightly offended, and gave Margaret no sympathy, indeed hardly any credit for the statement of her mother's indisposition. "How is Mr. Thornton?" asked Mr. Hale. "I was afraid he was not well from his hurried note yesterday." "My son is rarely ill, and when he is, he never speaks about it, or makes it an excuse for not doing anything. He told me he could not get leisure to read with you last night, sir. He regretted it, I am sure. He values the hours spent with you." "I am sure they are equally agreeable to me," said Mr. Hale. "It makes me feel young again to see his enjoyment and appreciation of all that is fine in classical literature. I have no doubt the classics are very desirable for people who have leisure, but I confess it was against my judgment that my son renewed his study of them. The time and place in which he lives seem to me to require all his energy and attention. Classics may do very well for men who loiter away their lives in the country or in colleges, but Milton men ought to have their thoughts and powers absorbed in the work of today. At least, that is my opinion." This last clause she gave out with the pride that apes humility.
"But surely, if the mind is too long directed to one object only, it will get stiff and rigid, and unable to take in many interests," said Margaret.
"I do not quite understand what you mean by a mind getting stiff and rigid, nor do I admire those whirligig characters that are full of this thing today to be utterly forgetful of it in their new interest tomorrow. Having many interests does not suit the life of a Milton manufacturer. It is or ought to be enough for him to have one great desire, and to bring all the purposes of his life to bear on the fulfilment of that." "And that is?" asked Mr. Hale. Her sallow cheek flushed, and her eye lightened as she answered, "To hold and maintain a high, honourable place among the merchants of his country, the men of his town. Such a place my son has earned for himself. Go where you will. I don't say in England only, but in Europe, the name of John Thornton of Milton is known and respected amongst all men of business. Of course it is unknown in the fashionable circles," she continued scornfully. "Idle gentlemen and ladies are not likely to know much of a Milton manufacturer unless he gets into Parliament or marries a lord's daughter." Both Mr. Hale and Margaret had an uneasy, ludicrous consciousness that they had never heard of this great name until Mr. Bell had written them word that Mr. Thornton would be a good friend to have in Milton. The proud mother's world was not their world of Harley Street gentilities, on the one hand, or country clergymen and Hampshire squires on the other. Margaret's face, in spite of all her endeavours to keep it simply listening in its expression, told the sensitive Mrs. Thornton this feeling of hers. "You think you never heard of this wonderful son of mine, Miss Hale. You think I'm an old woman whose ideas are bounded by Milton, and whose own crow is the whitest ever seen."
"No," said Margaret, with some spirit. "It may be true, but I was thinking I had hardly heard Mr. Thornton's name before I came to Milton. But since I have come here, I have heard enough to make me respect and admire him, and to feel how much justice and truth there is in what you have said of him."
"Who spoke to you of him?" asked Mrs. Thornton, a little mollified, yet jealous lest anyone else's words should not have done him full justice. Margaret hesitated before she replied. She did not like this authoritative questioning. Mr. Hale came in, as he thought, to the rescue.
"It was what Mr. Thornton said himself that made us know the kind of man he was. Was it not, Margaret?"
Mrs. Thornton drew herself up and said,
"My son is not one to tell of his own doings. May I again ask you, Miss Hale, from whose account you formed your favourable opinion of him?
A mother is curious and greedy of commendation of her children, you know.
Margaret replied, it was as much from what Mr. Thornton withheld of that which we had been told of his previous life by Mr. Bell. It was more that than what he said that made us all feel what reason you have to be proud of him.
Mr. Bell, what can he know of John? He living a lazy life in a drowsy college. But I'm obliged to you, Miss Hale. Many a missy young lady would have shrunk from giving an old woman the pleasure of hearing that her son was well spoken of.
Why? Asked Margaret, looking straight at Mrs. Thornton in bewilderment.
Why? Because I suppose they might have consciences that told them how surely they were making the old mother into an advocate for them, in case they had any plans on the son's heart.
She smiled a grim smile, for she had been pleased by Margaret's frankness, and perhaps she felt that she had been asking questions too much, as if she had a right to catechise. Margaret laughed outright at the notion presented to her, laughed so merrily but it grated on Mrs. Thornton's ear, as if the words that called forth that laugh must have been utterly and entirely ludicrous. Margaret stopped her merriment as soon as she saw Mrs. Thornton's annoyed look.
I beg your pardon, madam, but I really am very much obliged to you for exonerating me from making any plans on Mr. Thornton's heart.
Young ladies have before now, said Mrs. Thornton stiffly.
I hope Miss Thornton is well, put in Mr. Hale, desirous of changing the current of the conversation.
She is as well as she ever is. She is not strong, replied Mrs. Thornton shortly. And Mr. Thornton, I suppose I may hope to see him on Thursday. I cannot answer for my son's engagements. There is some uncomfortable work going on in the town, a threatening of a strike. If so, his experience and judgment will make him much consulted by his friends. But I should think he could come on Thursday. At any rate, I'm sure he will let you know if he cannot.
A strike? Asked Margaret. What for? What are they going to strike for?
For the mastership and ownership of other people's property, said Mrs. Thornton, with a fierce snort. That is what they always strike for. If my son's workpeople strike, I will only say they are a pack of ungrateful hounds, but I have no doubt they will. They are wanting higher wages, I suppose, asked Mr. Hale. That is the face of the thing. But the truth is, they want to be masters, and make the masters into slaves on their own ground. They are always trying at it. They always have it in their minds, and every 5 or 6 years there comes a struggle between masters and men. They'll find themselves mistaken this time, I fancy, a little out of their reckoning. If they turn out, they mayn't find it so easy to go in again. I believe the masters have a thing or two in their heads which will teach the men not to strike again in a hurry, if they try it this time.
Does it not make the town very rough? Asked Margaret.
Of course it does, but surely you are not a coward, are you? Milton is not the place for cowards. I have known the time when I have had to thread my way through a crowd of white angry men, all swearing they would have Mackinson's blood as soon as he ventured to show his nose out of his factory. And he, knowing nothing of it, someone had to go and tell him, or he was a dead man, and it needed to be a woman, so I went. And when I had got in, I could not get out. It was as much as my life was worth, so I went up to the roof, where there were stones piled ready to drop on the heads of the crowd if they tried to force the factory doors. And I would have lifted those heavy stones and dropped them with as good an aim as the best man there, but that I fainted with the heat I had gone through. If you live in Milton, you must learn to have a brave heart, Miss Hale.
I would do my best, said Margaret, rather pale. I do not know whether I am brave or not till I am tried, but I am afraid I should be a coward.
South country people are often frightened by what our Darkshire men and women only call living and struggling. But when you've been 10 years among a people who are always owing their betters a grudge, and only waiting for an opportunity to pay it off, you'll know whether you are a coward or not, take my word for it.
Mr. Thornton came that evening to Mr. Hale's. He was shown up into the drawing-room, where Mr. Hale was reading aloud to his wife and daughter.
I am come partly to bring you a note from my mother, and partly to apologise for not keeping to my time yesterday. The note contains the address you asked for, Dr. Donaldson.
Thank you,
said Margaret hastily, holding out her hand to take the note, for she did not wish her mother to hear that they had been making any inquiry about a doctor. She was pleased that Mr. Thornton seemed immediately to understand her feeling. He gave her the note without another word of explanation. Mr. Hale began to talk about the strike. Mr. Thornton's face assumed a likeness to his mother's worst expression, which immediately repelled the watching Margaret.
"Yes, the fools will have a strike. Let them. It suits us well enough. But we gave them a chance. They think trade is flourishing as it was last year. We see the storm on the horizon and draw in our sails. But because we don't explain our reasons, they won't believe we're acting reasonably. We must give them line and letter for the way we choose to spend or save our money. Henderson tried a dodge with his men out at Ashley and failed. He rather wanted a strike. It would have suited his book well enough. So when the men came to ask for the 5% they are claiming, he told them he'd think about it and give them his answer on the payday, knowing all the while what his answer would be, of course, but thinking he'd strengthen their conceit of their own way. However, they were too deep for him and heard something about the bad prospects of trade. So in they came on the Friday and drew back their claim, and now he's obliged to go on working. But we Milton masters have today sent in our decision. We won't advance a penny. We tell them we may have to lower wages, but can't afford to raise. So here we stand, waiting for the next attack.
And what will that be? Asked Mr. Hale.
I conjecture a simultaneous strike. You will see Milton without smoke in a few days, I imagine, Miss Hale.
But why? Asked she. Could you not explain what good reason you have for expecting a bad trade?
I don't know whether I use the right words, but you will understand what I mean.
Do you give your servants reasons for your expenditure, or your economy in the use of your own money? We, the owners of capital, have a right to choose what we will do with it.
A human right, said Margaret, very low.
I beg your pardon, I did not hear what you said.
I would rather not repeat it, said she. It related to a feeling which I do not think you would share.
Won't you try me? Pleaded he.
His thoughts suddenly bent upon learning what she had said. She was displeased with his pertinacity, but did not choose to affix too much importance to her words.
I said you had a human right. I meant that there seemed no reason but religious ones why you should not do what you like with your own.
I know we differ in our religious opinions, but don't you give me credit for having some, though not the same as yours.
He was speaking in a subdued voice, as if to her alone. She did not wish to be so exclusively addressed. She replied out in her usual tone,
I do not think that I have any occasion to consider your special religious opinions in the affair. All I meant to say is that there is no human law to prevent the employers from utterly wasting or throwing away all their money if they choose, but that there are passages in the Bible which would rather imply, to me at least, that they neglected their duty as stewards if they did so. However, I know so little about strikes and rate of wages and capital and labour that I had better not talk to a political economist like you.
Nay, the more reason, said he eagerly. I shall only be too glad to explain to you all that may seem anomalous or mysterious to a stranger, especially at a time like this, when our doings are sure to be canvassed by every scribbler who can hold a pen.
Thank you, she answered coldly. Of course I shall apply to my father in the first instance for any information he can give me if I get puzzled with living here amongst this strange society.
You think it strange? Why?
I don't know. I suppose because on the very face of it, I see two classes dependent on each other in every possible way, yet each evidently regarding the interests of the other as opposed to their own. I never lived in a place before where there were two sets of people always running each other down.
Who have you heard running the masters down? I don't ask who you have heard abusing the men, for I see you persist in misunderstanding what I said the other day. But who have you heard abusing the masters?
Margaret reddened, then smiled as she said,
I am not fond of being catechized. I refuse to answer your question. Besides, it has nothing to do with the fact. You must take my word for it, but I have heard some people,
Or it may be only some one of the workpeople speak as though it were the interest of the employers to keep them from acquiring money, but it would make them too independent if they had a sum in the savings bank. I dare say it was that man Higgins who told you all this, said Mrs. Hale. Mr. Thornton did not appear to hear what Margaret evidently did not wish him to know, but he caught it nevertheless. I heard, moreover, that it was considered to the advantage of the masters to have ignorant workmen, not hedge lawyers, as Captain Lennox used to call those men in his company, who questioned and would know the reason for every order. This latter part of her sentence she addressed rather to her father than to Mr. Thornton. "Who is Captain Lennox?" asked Mr. Thornton of himself, with a strange kind of displeasure that prevented him for the moment from replying to her. Her father took up the conversation.
"You never were fond of schools, Margaret, or you would have seen and known before this how much is being done for education in Milton."
"No," said she, with sudden meekness. "I know I do not care enough about schools, but the knowledge and the ignorance of which I was speaking did not relate to reading and writing, the teaching or information one can give to a child. I am sure that what was meant was ignorance of the wisdom that shall guide men and women. I hardly know what that is. But he, that is, my informant, spoke as if the masters would like their hands to be merely tall, large children, living in the present moment, with a blind, unreasoning kind of obedience."
"In short, Miss Hale, it is very evident that your informant found a pretty ready listener to all the slander he chose to utter against the masters," said Mr. Thornton in an offended tone. Margaret did not reply. She was displeased at the personal character Mr. Thornton affixed to what she had said. Mr. Hale spoke next.
"I must confess that although I have not become so intimately acquainted with any workman as Margaret has, I am very much struck by the antagonism between the employer and the employed, on the very surface of things. I even gather this impression from what you yourself have from time to time said."
Mr. Thornton paused a while before he spoke. Margaret had just left the room, and he was vexed at the state of feeling between himself and her. However, the little annoyance, by making him cooler and more thoughtful, gave a greater dignity to what he said.
"My theory is that my interests are identical with those of my workpeople and vice versa. Miss Hale, I know, does not like to hear men called hands, so I won't use that word, though it comes most readily to my lips as the technical term, whose origin, whatever it was, dates before my time. On some future day, in some millennium, in Utopia, this unity may be brought into practice, just as I can fancy a republic the most perfect form of government. We will read Plato's Republic as soon as we have finished Homer. Well, in the Platonic year, it may fall out that we are all, men, women, and children, fit for a republic. But give me a constitutional monarchy in our present state of morals and intelligence. In our infancy, we require a wise despotism to govern us. Indeed, long past infancy, children and young people are the happiest under the unfailing laws of a discreet, firm authority. I agree with Miss Hale so far as to consider our people in the condition of children, while I deny that we, the masters, have anything to do with the making or keeping them so. I maintain that despotism is the best kind of government for them, so that in the hours in which I come in contact with them, I must necessarily be an autocrat. I will use my best discretion, from no humbug or philanthropic feeling, of which we have had rather too much in the North, to make wise laws and come to just decisions in the conduct of my business. Laws and decisions which work for my own good in the first instance, for theirs in the second. But I will neither be forced to give my reasons, nor flinch from what I have once declared to be my resolution. Let them turn out. I shall suffer as well as they, but at the end they will find I have not baited nor altered one jot."
Margaret had re-entered the room and was sitting at her work, but she did not speak. Mr. Hale answered,
"I dare say I am talking in great ignorance, but from the little I know, I should say that the masses were already passing rapidly into the troublesome stage which intervenes between childhood and manhood, in the life of the multitude as well as that of the individual.
Now, the error which many parents commit in the treatment of the individual at this time is insisting on the same unreasoning obedience as when all he had to do in the way of duty was to obey the simple laws of come when you're called and do as you're bid. But a wise parent humours the desire for independent action so as to become the friend and advisor when his absolute rule shall cease,